After months of build-up and anticipation, Formula One got what it wanted most. A George Russell victory. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. What did you think I was going to be talking about? Kimi Antonelli's first podium? Welcome to episode 591 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. Glad you could join us. And wow, we got a triple header of recordings over the next few days for you. We're doing two tonight, one tomorrow in real world time. Obviously, they'll be spaced out a little bit more when we get to actual releases and whatnot. But we're starting with one of the best Formula One rounds on the calendar, in my humble opinion. It's the Canadian Grand Prix from Montreal, the Circuit Gilles Villeneuve. And well, let's just say this was a bit of a slow burner to start off with, but it got interesting towards the end. And well, you could make a case that we got our second major championship flashpoint as well, as Papaya Rules did not save Lando Norris's front wing, or his left front tire for that matter. Let's talk about it a little bit. Joining me, as ever, is Mr. Cameron Buckley. Hello, sir.
Yeah, I mean, that rear end job, that's going to be a hell of an insurance claim for Lando. I mean, how do you explain that?
As they said on Top Gear, this is going to need more than that little box on the insurance form. Yeah, good luck trying to explain that one. Also joining us, and he's finally back from a string of traveling, and he's going to be out here on Thursday again as well, bless him.
Oh, damn, he didn't get any sleep. He's falling asleep on the camera, Dre.
Yeah, wouldn't be the first time. Joining us, I mean, finally returned from Le Mans, it's Rory James O'Connell.
How dare you accuse me of pulling a Mike Francesa and falling asleep on air during a podcast recording?
Never.
It would never happen whatsoever.
We'll talk about it a little bit more, obviously, in the main designated episode, but how was Le Mans, my friend?
To put it simply before I get into it, it was fun. It's always fun to be there in person. If you've never been, you should go. If you have been, you should go again. More on that in the next episode. But man, Canada sure did happen.
Yeah, that is safe to say. We had a genuinely very interesting Grand Prix. Maybe not the most exciting Grand Prix in the world, but one where a lot of narratives got busted, new ones were created, some interesting storylines to take away from it all. A lot to break down. George Russell, first Grand Prix win of the year for him, first Grand Prix win of the year for Mercedes, double podium as well, first time since Vegas last year for them. Max Verstappen back into decent form, a very solid second place for him on the day. And, well, the McLarens collided. We had a six-hour wait in the stewards' office before the results became official, so we'll be talking about that as well. Ferrari, and hey, they're not seriously thinking about getting rid of Fred Vasseur already, are they? Are they? More on that.
Well, it would be incredibly Ferrari of them if they did.
You're not wrong. I'll say that for sure. Canada is going to be sticking around for a little bit longer, and the 2026 F1 calendar dropped this week as well with some interesting changes. It's the definite case of the more things change, the more they stay the same, but kind of in reverse. We'll talk about that a little bit later as well. But before that, places you can find us real quick. Just gonna have a quick sneeze. Oop. Is this happening? No? I don't want to risk it in case I can feel it coming, but it's like no, I'm good. Okay, we'll plow.
It's just like the tease of Aston Martin taking that next step out of the midfield.
Yeah, never going to happen. YouTube.com/Motorsport101. We're on Facebook.com/Motorsport101. We're on Instagram at Motorsport101Pod. You can follow us there and on TikTok at M101_podcast for visual highlights of the show and some bonus content from yours truly as well on whatever happens happening in the world of F1. You could also check out our website, motorsport101.com. We can read reviews of both this race and IndyCar's latest oval race at Gateway. Probably the best IndyCar race we've had all year. We'll be talking more about that at the weekend, so you can look forward to that. If you can follow us on Twitter, motorsport_101. You can follow us personally on Blue Sky if you like, at dreharrison.bsky.social, cbuckley917 for Cam, and RJ O'Connell for RJ. And of course, if you really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. That includes podcast episodes, bonus bits from blog, stuff that doesn't make the final cut, all sorts of things. And you can upgrade to the $10 tier to be able to listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded. Thank you very much for your ongoing support over there as ever. Right. Without further ado, let's get into the 2025 Canadian Grand Prix.
Formula One's Canadian Grand Prix was a very tight, strategic affair. George Russell of Mercedes started from pole and dictated control for most of the race, pulling away from Red Bull's Max Verstappen when he needed to. Two stops later, Russell was holding on to a two-second lead, but Verstappen was under pressure from rookie Kimi Antonelli and the two McLarens behind him, with Oscar Piastri barely in front of Lando Norris. This was kind of a snoozer, but with five laps to go, Norris shoots the gap on the inside of the home straight, hits Piastri's car, and goes into the wall, taking himself out of the race, which ended under safety car in big 2025. Russell takes Mercedes' first double podium since Vegas last year. Max Verstappen is the meat in the silver era sandwich, and with Oscar Piastri fourth, his lead in the championship extends to 22 points. Dre, George Russell has low-key been one of the best drivers all season. Are you surprised that it took him this long to win one of these?
Yes, but only because McLaren's just been that good. There's the sneeze. only because
delayed five minutes later.
Yeah, it was the Hercule rolling dynamite delay sneeze. The only reason it was a surprise is because McLaren's just been that good. They had won what, 7 out of 9 going into this race weekend, yep. And you know, even if McLaren were having a not so good day, Max has been there to punish them and pick up the pieces. He's been the nearest competitor to Mercedes for most of the season so far. So for George Russell to pretty much be the fastest person across the weekend, you know, was on pole by a tenth and a half. He really does love Canada, especially over a single lap. He was on pole here last year. He was on pole again this year. Quite frankly, the fact he just completely controlled this race weekend was about as impressive a weekend performance as I've ever seen from George Russell, probably since Vegas last year, where he was just completely dominant. And we know why, because the Mercedes, well, last year, and certainly I think it's been shown again this year.
There's elements of it this year, definitely.
Yeah. Where
it likes the cold.
Yeah, it likes the cold. Its performance very much depends on the weather and the atmosphere and how hot it is and whether they can keep their tires in their ideal operating window. That's played massively into Mercedes' fortunes for the last year and a half. And I thought, with Canada being quite hot on Sunday, I think the track temperature was over 50 degrees. I thought, well they're just going to fade in the race because they're just not going to be able to keep their tires fresh. Nope. Didn't happen. George was able to just stretch out and find extra pace when he needed to. And that's what made him so strong. And Max just didn't have an answer for him after Russell withstood the early pressure.
Yeah, I mean, as far as race day went, I mean, the biggest thing that kept that Mercedes in play. If you spent any length of time in the dirty air of another car, your tires simply shattered. They were so fragile. Every compound was so fragile this weekend, to the point where Max got on the front row running a set of mediums because the mediums would actually stick together across a lap better than the soft would, at least until Russell put that pole lap in. But yeah, because the delta here of dirty air was about a second and a half, and any closer you were just munching your tires. No one could really mount an assault on him. Max gave it a couple solid goes, and just destroyed his tires doing so on both occasions. And George ends up with a relatively comfortable victory. It was weird because he was fastest in FP2, and he said himself, like, that's all I can get out of the car. Well, that's all anyone else could get out of the cars.
Yeah.
Kind of just maintain that same kind of margin over everyone else for most of this weekend.
Yeah, we didn't need, you know, like, the thing about it is that it felt like, you know, Max was giving it everything, and we all just kind of assumed that McLaren would just have more because that's what they've been for most of this season. And that never really came. Like, in qualifying, they were not quite there. Norris was particularly poor in qualifying in Q3, only could manage seventh on the grid. Tried to make an alternate strategy work by starting on the hard tire as opposed to starting on the medium like the majority of the field had done. We'll get to him later. But it was bizarre in a sense where everybody was kind of struggling a little bit. I don't think anybody was operating at their maximum. But I think the combination of Mercedes always going well in Canada, they like Canada. They've always liked Canada. Mercedes as a team, they've generally been pretty strong there in recent years. Combine that with tires that operated well for them. You know, they had extra pace when they needed to activate it. Max, again, was caught in dirty air hell for most of that race. And that's what I think what Cam's alluding to. It ended up being just a bit of a dirty air stalemate for the vast majority of this race. Like I've said it before, there's no worse place to be in Formula One than the third man in a DRS train. And yeah, it's what led to this race kind of being a slow burner until the final 10 to 15 laps.
And even then, with that dirty air in play, like, again, if you got the death zone in terms of your tires was about a second and a half, and anyone who got closer would just kind of get stuck there. And Piastri lost out to Kimi Antonelli in the first sequence of corners, and then couldn't really mount an assault on him either. We'll talk a little bit about Kimi Antonelli. God has his first podium.
I'm glad he was so humble to wait 10 rounds before he got it, so it's just so he didn't end up, you know, scaring the plebs. You know, had to wait for the new Pope to get in as well. That was apparently very important. So he's got his representation in place, and now he's able to start giving it the beans. So we're glad Kimi now has his first podium. Praise be and glory to Pope Antonelli the First, etc.
Do you know if Pope Antonelli is also a Chicago sports fan?
I hope not. Poor guy. That man would definitely need a blessing if that were the case. But I mean, Antonelli drove for his life out there. Like he had a whole lot of pressure to deal with. He was fighting Max genuinely for second at times. In the final round of pit stops, they pretty much came out side by side from turn two. Max obviously with a bit more natural momentum, having already completed his tire warm up and was in the window, and Antonelli had to fall back. But he was right there with Verstappen the whole Grand Prix, less than 2 seconds behind him, was under a lot of pressure at the end when the McLarens found a bit of late race speed. But he was able to hold them off, even with DRS towards the end of the race. Antonelli never really looked like he was going to lose out on third. And yeah, brilliant drive from the teenager. That was a mature, well-rounded, strong performance from a guy that looked like he'd been doing this for 5 years already.
Mm-hmm. That's the whole thing about Antonelli, is that he comes in with the poise and the maturity that you expect of somebody who's been doing this for a while, as you said, Trey. And that seems like it was evident. Like, there's a reason why he skipped a level to get to F2, and there was a reason why, even if he didn't win the championship at F2, which he did, he looked like it was already a finished product that was ready for F1.
Yeah, it was a weird one. I was one of the people that were more cynical about Antonelli because he skipped F3, because, you know, he was good in F2. I wouldn't necessarily say he was great in F2, but the weekends in F2 where Kimi was strong, he was strong. Like that sprint win at Silverstone, the feature race win in Hungary, when Antonelli was on it, he was on it, and he looked like the S-tier prospect that many people thought he was. You know, I don't want to say I need to see more because he's competing alongside George Russell on the other side of the garage, who, as I've said, is having an excellent season. He's driven the nuts off that Mercedes all year long. It would be unfair to compare Kimi in his rookie season to what George Russell is doing right now in an F1 car. But the fact that Antonelli was, what, less than 4 seconds off the win by the time before the safety car dropped at the end of this race is mighty impressive. Like, it's very, very strong. You could see the upside in him, and you could see why Toto Wolff was prepared to let Hamilton walk at this stage in his career because he didn't want to lose out on a talent like him.
Yeah, I mean, and unfortunately, his points tally doesn't reflect how good a year he's been having, because up to this point, he had two engine failures in the last 3 weekends, which also puts him on potential for grid penalties for the rest of this year. A big spate of Mercedes engine failures in this last month and a half or so, all except in the McLarens, which is keeping this season decidedly uninteresting in the World Constructors Championship.
Oh, brother, no kidding. And on top, and compounding that uninterestingness, Dre, explain to me the Max Verstappen conundrum, because I'm about to have a guess. It's because Max Verstappen is once again second and doing all that he can to try and take the fight to the McLarens and the Mercedes and everybody else, while Yuki Tsunoda's just racked up his third non-scoring finish. I want to die.
I mean, you're mildly. Yeah. I mean, this was Yuki Tsunoda's 100th career start in Formula One. He's in the 100 club, which is already wild for a guy that looks like he's only been here for a hot minute. But you pretty much got it in one, RJ. It's Verstappen, again, drove the nuts off this Red Bull, had a really, really just good all-round, really solid weekend. Max, after the Grand Prix, pretty much acknowledged second was the maximum he was going to get out of this weekend, and he got it. He openly admitted he didn't have an answer for George when it was really all said and done. But he's taken points out of the McLarens, which is a good result, quite frankly. It's about as good as you could have hoped for, given Red Bull's current predicament. It was a weekend where Max, for what, third time this year? Genuinely better than McLaren. And yeah, again, outstanding weekend. He barely put a foot wrong all the time by. This despite being under immense pressure from Sky Sports to please have an accident with George Russell into turn one, because we need to accelerate the news that Verstappen's going to be banned for a race if he does. They tried so hard on this one. They really, really tried. And I've got thoughts on this, and they have a wide range of, one, please stop poking the bear, Ted Kravitz. Dude, you've been in this paddock nearly 30 years. You know exactly what you're doing when you're coming out with, really, below-the-belt statements in regards to whether Max is going to just plow into George Russell because he's a hothead, and he does this every weekend, apparently, and that's basically what they've been insinuating. I don't like it. On the other hand, on the other side of the coin, Rachel Brooks had to deactivate the comments on her social media due to the amount of abuse she was getting for asking Verstappen perfectly valid questions. It's a very careful knife that we're walking on right now, and I don't like it. It's very 2021, and unfortunately, when you've got one of the most volatile fan bases in sport, let alone Formula One, it brings out the worst in people, you know, on their keyboards and with microphones in some cases too. It's all just a little bit ridiculous, and I wish it would stop. I really do. It's just...
I'm kind of just waiting for this powder keg to go off, because there's so much poking of the bears back and forth on both sides of the equation. There's so much just nastiness in it that something's going to set it off.
Yeah.
Whether he gets a race ban or not.
Sky and Red Bull clearly do not like each other. There is clear.
Oh, what gave you that impression, Harrison?
Oh, I don't know. you know, bear poking, below the belt interviews, hassling Christian Horner and Horner giving it back. Horner putting the whole sport into disrepute last year. These two entities do not like each other. It's a very, in my opinion, fractured relationship. And they do kind of need each other. I'm stunned we've not had another media boycott from Red Bull since Mexico a few years ago when that went down, when Kravitz disparaged the whole team on his notebook show. Like, I'm stunned it hasn't happened again. I think we're getting close to that point where we're just going to say, you know what, we don't want to talk to you no more. And it's ugly. It doesn't help anybody. No one wins in these sorts of, like, ugly media wars. Just get on with it, guys. You know, just talk to people in a normal manner.
Go car racing.
We had a motor race, etc. And this is the problem. And to carry on from what RJ was alluding to, because, like I said, Yuki Tsunoda is now in the 100 club. The man's struggling. I wouldn't say he's drowning, like what we got with Liam Lawson, but the water's neck deep.
What happened after
Bahrain? Doesn't have to be that high with Yuki, unfortunately.
Yeah.
What happened after Bahrain? Because, okay, home track advantage, I'll give you a pass on that. Bahrain was relatively good. What's happened since?
I mean, he's only just got on equivalent spec with Verstappen after he made a mess of things in Imola where he turned that car inside out. And that was the only spec of that floor that he was allocated, because this is a cost cap sport and you have to, if you're going to put the eggs in the Verstappen basket, you're going to put all of them in the Verstappen basket.
Eggs aren't cheap these days. Let's not forget.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Especially when there's articles going, why were they ever cheap? Anyway, sickos. Anyway, it's a cascading series of problems. And unfortunately, how many more teammates are going to go into the Max Verstappen grinder at this point?
Isaac Hadjer, I think, said, don't send me up to Red Bull before I'm ready.
Yeah.
Will he be ready? There's a short list of people who I think you could put in the Red Bull and be able to somewhat compete with Max. And it's like three drivers long. And even then, I'm not so sure.
And I'm pretty sure two of them would not change the team they're currently driving for.
No.
Red Bull have had to lean in on their academy because they've had no choice. They are not prepared to spend big money for another second driver of the elite level. The only team that's paying that kind of bread to do so is Ferrari, because Ferrari can do so. Their academy has been, as Bomani Jones would say, a bunch of low spades. You know, Liam Lawson showed promise, but was probably put in too soon. Yuki Tsunoda is a talented driver, but again, it's the same shit we've been saying about Red Bull for years. They have a car that only one person can extract the maximum potential out of. Otherwise, it's a tricky bastard, and it doesn't suit most drivers' driving styles. And
the problem is, at this point, it doesn't even really suit Max either at this point. And Max has been very open about that he can, in a very Marc Marquez style way, kind of just get up on the wheel and drive through it. That has manifested this year with Red Bull in really not being great on their tires, which is a continuation from last year.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that Max can kind of deal with it, but he's still not happy about it. Anyone else who's in that seat is drowning. And Yuki had pretty decent race pace, all things considered, but when you're starting from bumfuck last, there's not a whole lot to be done, especially with the fragility of the tires and the dirty air in play here in Canada.
Yeah, and this also isn't like the Red Bulls of a few years ago. This isn't the Mercedes of the late 2010s, where, yeah, if you start at the back, it's impressive, but is it really that impressive where you could drive through the field like a butter knife? Not really. It ain't like that this time.
No.
No, and yeah, just like you said, Tsunoda did have to take a 10-place grid drop because he passed Oscar Piastri's damaged car in FP3 while under red flag. He was unlucky in a sense, but there was no good reason for Yuki to overtake Oscar on track. It was one of those ones where you just go, Yuki, that's silly. you know, it's just completely unnecessary. Yeah, it's Red Bull trying to extract every drop of pace out of a frame that they can't get any more speed out of. Max being a freakish talent that can just drive around its weaknesses and problems to the point where he can match anybody on his day. And unfortunately, Red Bull having no one else in its arsenal that can replicate that. And it says a lot when Isaac Hadjar, who is every bit as ambitious as every other Red Bull junior that's talked themselves into thinking they can handle this car, when he's openly saying, "I'm not ready to drive this car," we've not had any Red Bull junior say that in recent years. Liam Lawson wasn't out here saying, "Oh, you know, I'm not ready to go yet. Please delay me." And this is a guy that was in a Red Bull after 11 career starts.
And he was so gung-ho that it's turned people off of him for God knows what reason. But yeah.
It's such a baffling state of events at Red Bull where it's Schrodinger's Ref 1 team. They're a title contender, but they're also the worst of the elite contenders at the same time. You're fighting for a title while also a team that's allegedly in turmoil at the same time. It's like, we don't know what Red Bull it's going to be at each race weekend until we open the box. It's ridiculous.
We don't know what Red Bull it's going to be until we're like halfway through the first stint, because sometimes they're out there and you're thinking, this isn't too bad. Had Max been able to jump George, you know, at turn one, did not get a great start, and George was pretty much unchallenged into one, he probably wins this race on the dirty air and tire fragility factor.
Yeah.
And then you have races like Spain where they're throwing three stops at McLaren, trying to just see what will stick. And then they put Max on fresh hards to finish the race, and Max goes through industrial strength levels of head loss.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that head loss, this should have really been a good, you know, a good weekend to reel in the McLarens, keep them within 2-3 races. Instead, he cut the gap, but it was a huge 3 to cut the lead to 43.
Yeah, the literal Chris Ball scenario. He took 6 points out of Piastri this weekend, which, look, it's a plus. You take those where you can get them, but he needs to take bigger chunks out of Piastri and Norris going forward if he's to have any chance of winning this championship, because he's still down by the better part of 2 Grand Prix.
Yeah. Speaking of taking chunks out of McLaren's.
Yeah, when are we talking about the Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri collision, Dre?
How about now? So we've got about 10 laps to go. As mentioned, Lando Norris was on an alternate strategy. He started the race on the hard compound tire compared to most of the field that started on the medium compound tire. Now, this was also a race where the C4, 5, and 6 were used this weekend, very similar to what we got at the other street tracks this year and Imola. As a result, like, basically the C5 is now a race tire. And, well, Pirelli got their wish. This was a 2-stop race. And basically, Norris was on the freshest set of hard tires at the end of the race. He was doing what Lando Norris does very well, trying to maximize performance on a big tire delta. He does that better than anyone else in the field. And, well, he got to the back of Oscar Piastri and that group chasing for the win. He's putting Piastri under more and more pressure. Piastri gets a bit of a blessing with about 7 laps to go because he's now starting to inherit Antonelli's DRS, because Antonelli's dropped back a little bit and he's given the McLaren's DRS to play with. And while the leading up to this crash, on the lap before, Norris sends one at Piastri at the bottom of the hairpin, is briefly in front, but doesn't get the drive out of the corner. They're going side by side towards the final chicane. Norris brakes earlier, trying to get the better run out of the chicane because Piastri is braking deep to defend. They're chasing each other down towards turn one. Piastri's parked on the left-hand side of the track. Norris has gone deeper to the left, and in a scene reminiscent of Lewis Hamilton doing the same to Jenson Button in the wet back in 2011, he drives into the rear of Piastri's car. The collision puts him in the wall, breaks his front left suspension and tire. Norris's day is done. Safety car deployed. Game over. basically, right there and then. George Russell wins. Oscar Piastri's car is undamaged. He's able to finish in fourth. Norris is done. Norris also, for the record, gets a 5-second time penalty after the race because technically...
championship defining.
Oh, yeah.
Of knock wappy over here.
Implications, baby. Implications. To be a nerd for a second, the reason he got 5 seconds was because he was still technically a finisher because he completed more than 90% race distance. In F1, if you complete more than 90%, you are deemed a finisher, even if you don't actually complete all of the race itself. So they couldn't give him a grid drop because he finished the race. So not that it matters or anything. He didn't even get any penalty points for it, which I have a big problem with. I'll talk about that in a minute. But Lando. What are we going to do with you? Somewhere, Cam Buckley's about to eat a whole bucket of chum. Not like that.
I don't know what you're referencing is why I'm making that face.
It's the face of humble pie. Because I know you've been down on Norris before.
This isn't even like me being my typical down on Norris. I just thought this was really stupid. I don't really have anything to like. The thing is, if he had overlap on Oscar, I might have seen the vision. I would have disagreed with it, but I would have seen the vision. He quite literally never overlapped with him.
No.
He just misjudged it and drove into the back of him like someone with a donut in one hand and their phone in the other, steering with their knees going down the highway in Florida. You never want to be compared to Florida Man.
No.
In regards to your racing driving, what was he thinking? What was he cooking?
He was being too ambitious. He was trying to shoot a gap that was never there. Any veteran would take the whole right-hand side of the track that he had to play with, because even if you don't pass him by turn one into the braking zone, you can possibly hang it around the outside and come back for turn two on the inside. That
got a better and worse idea, Dre. We know the rules of engagement these days. If Oscar is going to run you out, make sure that you're ahead at the apex and then bail out and say that he ran you off. He'll make sure that you give the penalty to the guy behind.
Annoyingly, Oscar Piastri is quite sensible with everybody not named Max. So I actually don't think Piastri would run his own teammate off wide. Probably. But you make a valid point, annoyingly.
I'm not so sure with these silly-ass F1 drivers anymore.
I mean, if anything, and this is on a deeper dive. I mean, look, I don't disagree with anything or what Cam's saying. This was a stupid move. It was head loss. I think Norris was frustrated. I think he'd lost his patience. And I think he was going for a Hollywood move that was never going to stick. Piastri owned that part of the racetrack, and there was not enough room to shoot a MotoGP bike down there, let alone a Formula One car. On a greater level, a part of me feels bad for Lando. And this is something that I think it's a bit weird to say, because I'm talking about Lando on a macro level here, not the micro level of this crash. I feel bad for him. And the reason why I feel bad for him is because, and this is a sincere question, has anybody in Formula One gotten more nitpicky shit? I'm not talking like big criticism. I'm talking like little criticisms, the passive aggressive types of criticisms, than Lando Norris has in the last 2 years.
In the last 2 years?
Probably not.
It's tough to say
I say this because it feels like there's a lot. You know what he is? He's like Flubber. A lot of people are trying, I think, in my opinion, to stretch Lando Norris into something he's not. And it worries me to a degree that I don't think he's being protected enough by McLaren. And it worries me because Lando is very different to your average elite driver when it comes to Formula One. I think Norris is actually very similar to Lewis Hamilton Because, like, the self-depreciation, the harsh criticisms of himself, the head being down when he has a bad day, it's very Hamilton-esque. You know,
yeah, he was the first one to take blame for the incident before he even looked back and saw it.
Yeah, like Norris. Yep. Norris was extremely. To be fair to Norris, he didn't even contest it. He admitted immediately it was his own fault. It was stupid, and he apologized profusely to Oscar and everybody on the team. Like, this wasn't some racing driver arrogant. Oh, the other guy did something. No, he fully owned it, and I applaud him for that. And you know, it was wild to get a bit of behind-the-scenes talk here, because I'm someone who edits a lot of Autosport and the Motorsport Network's content from a video and audio standpoint. I'm hearing journos in their ears talking about that Norris shouldn't have been so honest. He should have bitten back. He should have been less respectful in regards to what had happened, and he should have given it back a little bit like Verstappen did at Spain. And I'm sitting here going, that's not him. That's not who Lando Norris is as a human being or as a racing driver. The self-depreciating nature of Lando is his strength. That's how he motivates himself. That's how he shuts out a lot of that criticism. That's how he handles the week to week. I don't like this narrative that you've got to be this ruthless killer on an F1 track to win a world championship. I don't think Lewis Hamilton was particularly wired that way. Brilliant racing driver. But look, what is killer
instinct? Depends if Nico Rosberg was on his outside.
True. You're not wrong. But, like, this whole idea of you need this ruthless style of killer instinct to win a world champ, what is that?
It's because a lot of people in my generation grew up around people who said Senna was the best driver of all time, and we know what he was like.
Schumacher.
People in my generation grew up with Michael Schumacher. We know what he's like. And now we have a younger generation that sees Max Verstappen as the greatest driver of all time, and we know what he's like. So we just think these are the three greatest in the sport, and if you're not wired like them, you aren't cut out for this shit.
It's not just a Formula One thing. I mean, there is an entire major subsection of NBA fans who believe Michael Jordan is the only clutch player who ever lived, and everyone else were a bunch of pansies.
Yeah, it's. I think a lot of this is the male, macho, chauvinistic gaze that we view sports at. Because let's be honest, most sports are male-dominated. Most sports are dominated by male viewership. So we imprint our values as men upon the sport we watch. And on a deeper dive mental health level, as a man, I'm 32 years old for context. I've grown up in a generation where for the first time men are a lot more open about their mental health because politics is my Jamaican heritage. We were not supposed to be able to talk about these things. We're supposed to man up. We're supposed to be tough. We're supposed to be the breadwinners. We're supposed to be the ones that suck it up and just get on with it because that's what we're told to do because we don't want to, quote, show weakness as a man when, you know, you talk about life in society and how we get down from a day-to-day basis. Lando Norris, in my opinion, is a genuine breath of fresh air for the elitism we have in Formula One. Like, him and Lewis are refreshingly honest people when it comes to their, like Hamilton described Spain a couple of weeks ago as the worst race of his life. And, like, I know it's a bit melodramatic because Lewis is very hot on sleeve, but 15 years ago, we would have said, oh, has Lewis Hamilton got the mental fortitude to be able to be a world champion? And we're talking about him as the greatest of all time, quite possibly, almost certainly, in the eyes of most. Like, I worry on a human level that Lando's going to get pulled into being something that he's not. I don't want him to be this ruthless aggression batshit motherfucker like Max. If anything, and this is something that doesn't have a lot of mental skin in this game, I don't want Lando Norris to be something he's not if he has to win a world championship that way. I hope it doesn't get to that point, because I think he is talented enough where he doesn't have to. The talent's all there. Like, the last year, he's had 6 Grand Prix wins, he's had 10 pole positions, he's had 19 podiums. He's good enough to win a world championship. And yes, he's got to stop making mistakes. I'm not disputing that. Compared to Oscar, Oscar has been the better driver so far this year. And Oscar's not been perfect either. Hardly.
No, not at all.
Like, but unfortunately, I think Oscar gets an easier shake because he's the new entry into the elite club. And I think a lot of people have rooted for him to succeed from the time he was a rookie 2 years ago. This is year 7 for Lando Norris. We've been through the honeymoon period with him, and I think that ended last year, because a lot of the more cynical F1 fans thought Norris should have definitely won last year's title, and I don't think it was simple as that. That's how I feel about this, personally.
Make a number of good points. I think, yeah, Norris's ability to self-deprecate, I think his personality does contrast against a lot of the other elite drivers of the sport. And I like that contrast. I like the contrast of him versus Russell, of him versus Max Verstappen, when you really push them to their limits.
Right.
If everybody is a ruthless killer out on track, nobody's a ruthless killer.
Well, I don't know if I go that far. Ask the people trying to budget in the repairs.
Yeah, but that's just it. We've been told for the last 30, nearly 40 years when it comes to F1, that's the only way you can win. And I don't think it's as simple as that.
Was that the way that Mika Hakkinen won his back-to-back times? Was that necessarily, like, do you ever think of, like, Fernando? Yes, you think of Fernando Alonso as a bit of a backstage politician, but do you ever think of somebody who's willing to crash into another driver to win a race or a championship?
Well, when he himself was talking about his own pass on Schumacher, going, I knew he would back out. He has a wife and kids at home.
Not a real quote.
Well,
not a real quote. I need to point that out. People think it's real. It was AI generated.
generated AI again.
I've been sent-held.
Sorry.
Damn. Cam Buckley has been sent hell. That's Buckley with his title like that.
Like,
Sebastian Vettel, like, he did run into Hamilton that one time, but
Jensen Button, is he that guy?
I mean, people can't make up their minds whether Seb was too mentally weak to win a title or
too much of a dickhead, apparently.
Yeah. Well, how dare you go out and take your win from your teammate via team orders? Wait, don't we hate team orders? Shh, not for this guy.
Yeah, because people just didn't want to see Seb win, because people just thought finger pointing meant he was a dick. Like, we couldn't make our minds up with Seb for years.
Yeah.
The story of Sebastian.
We can't make our minds up with Max now. The same thing that gets Max praised as the modern reincarnation of Ayrton Senna. He drove into someone deliberately a week and a half ago.
Yeah.
Senna decided a title by deliberately crashing someone.
And we looked at Senna like a god.
And a lot of people still do.
Yeah. And that was 35 years ago.
Hey, there was a protest after the race, from what I understand. I didn't follow this that closely because, again,
I got you.
Other commitments at work.
Okay, here's the deal. About 2 hours after the race was over, Red Bull launched a formal protest of the results. They made two rights to review in regard to the end of the race. George Russell allegedly being 10 car lengths back, or more than 10 car lengths back, of the safety car at the end of the race because they were running it through pit lane. And, quote, driving erratically under the safety car because George Russell put some heavy braking down. Max had briefly overtaken George under that safety car because he was responding to George's heavy braking. And George apparently said some team radio that sounded a bit like he was trying to wind Max up into that 12th penalty point we talked about earlier. So Red Bull launched two appeals against the result. They rescinded one of them. I believe it was the car length rule, because they realized on the data that George was just following his delta. The delta that was on his steering wheel was fine. There was never a case to answer to. Unfortunately, because there was a lot of post-race incidents the stewards had to clear up, i.e., I think Sainz was accused of reckless driving, Ollie Bearman had a questionable rejoin that had to be looked at, seven cars overtook under yellow even after the race was over, because even though it was a checkered flag, there was still a yellow zone where Norris had crashed the car. You're not supposed to overtake under yellow even after the race is over. And the McLaren clash was a stewards incident, so they had to go through all of them. Now, to briefly explain, these incidents are looked at in order of when they're filed. So because Red Bull's appeal was the last thing to go through, it was on the bottom of the list. And so by the time it was settled, I think it was about 3 a.m. in the morning UK time. So I want to say about 9 p.m. local, about 5.5 hours after the race had actually finished. Like, I remember our journos at motorsport.com filmed a live reaction to it, and it was pitch black by the time it was done, because they still hadn't been able to leave the track yet. And a lot of people wrote lengthy articles saying it's an embarrassing look for Formula One that it took this long to settle the result. And, well, I don't know how I feel about this. I think this one's actually... I can't believe I'm going to say this. I actually feel bad for the stewards on this one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Clip it. And clip it. Post it to social media first.
The man who coined Knock Wappy, and that's not AI-generated, feels bad for the stewards.
There's a couple of reasons why, so hear me out on this one, right? Because you know me, I would never normally say shit like this. Number one, Derek Warwick had been sent home.
Now, why is that?
Because Derek Warwick had called Max Verstappen, quote-unquote, a disaster after what had happened at the Spanish Grand Prix 2 weeks ago. Now, that's already questionable, but see if you can remember this story. He was giving quotes via a PR company to gambling sites. Ring any bells, gentlemen?
He took the funny money. He took the funny money.
Dude, you know that meme of the football ref with the caption, "I know his ass is gambling"? Derek Warwick is an accomplished racing driver, but some of the decisions he had made as F1 steward really embody that meme.
Yeah, I love that my colleague at Autosport, Stuart Codlin, said it was the worst mistake Derek Warwick's made since the Italian Grand Prix of 1990. If you know, you know.
Was that the wreck out of Parabolico where he crashes and his car splits in half?
Yeah, that one. It was a good joke. I love my man Codders. I will say exactly what I said when Johnny Herbert was let go as a steward by the FIA at the end of last year. You are a sports official. You cannot take bookmaker money when you can directly impact the result of a race.
No kidding.
It is a huge conflict of interest. It is a huge sports integrity conflict. You cannot, like, let's put it this way. For those who don't know, because for those who might be newer to the show or don't know me very well, I was a bookies manager for 6.5 years, right? I will tell you for free, if Derek Warwick was recognized and walked into a bookies, he would not be allowed to put a bet on a Formula One race. For obvious reasons, he's an official. You can directly impact a race. Even if he wasn't stewarding the race he was betting on, he still can't do it, because even though he can't directly influence the result, he might know someone who can. It's inside information. You cannot do it. And honestly, that would be bad enough as it is, because some people just literally don't know that sort of shit. You saw Johnny Herbert get fired for this a year ago. Less than a year ago. Less than 6 months ago. How stupid have you got to be to see what happened to Herbert and then get caught doing the same thing yourself?
It's like seeing a number of American sports athletes get suspensions and shit for betting on like other sports. And like the whole thing is just like, oh, how could we let online betting and sports do this to our defenseless athletes who clearly don't know, but you know what you're doing, man.
And some of these people like Jameson Williams are doing it inside their own stadium. Because like how the NFL is tracking this. You can't be this stupid.
They got your ass in 4K. This is the highest res shit ever.
Like, Derek Warwick is in his 70s. He really should know better. And look, there is probably an overall overriding point that we really should be paying these stewards at this point. Because if you were paying them, I reckon you'd be far less likely to have them get caught with their hands in the cookie jar.
Yeah.
But we don't pay stewards in, and the FIA is mostly built off volunteer power for clout. And when that happens, unfortunately, you're going to lead for people wanting to make a quick buck on the side, because what industry has more free marketing cash than bookmakers? None!
Not even cigarettes back in the day, I don't think.
Bookies have money for marketing out the wazoo, because in the land of the bookies, customer acquisition is everything in that industry. You want loyal punters to keep coming back and to keep gambling with you, because 90% of your money as a bookmaker comes from repeat business. I'll tell you that for free. You don't get new faces walking into a bookmaker's very often. It's the same 20 dudes day in, day out, right? That's how it goes. So that is why bookmakers throw money at marketing opportunities, because it's name recognition, it's brand recognition, it's customer acquisition, clout, 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 clout. It's why half the Premier League have got betting sponsors on their shirts now, or stadiums named after a bookmaker. It's why every minor sports event is backed by a bookmaker. The Paddy Power World Darts Championship, the Daffabet World Snooker Championship. I could go on and on and on. Sports now, obviously, American sports incorporating gambling into every facet of its broadcasts. It's horrible. I hate it. I could rant about this for another half hour if I really wanted to. I'm going to spare you the trouble. Derek Warwick is a fool for that. Like, look, real talk. If you know why, he's very lucky to still be a steward. Very lucky. He's like the cat with nine lives, because Herbert was fired. Warwick was only suspended for a race. He'll be back in Austria next weekend.
can't wait. That's fine. Won't stop me because I can't read.
It's stupid, man.
Speaking of stupid decisions,
Dre, we have to turn it back to the red corner.
Dre, is this a real headline? Like, is this whole we need a sack for... That's not real. That's a psyop.
Well, the Italian press disagree.
The Italian press.
Italian press are desperate.
Yeah, Fred had to come out with some pretty defensive comments on Thursday and Friday in regards to the reports saying that his job may be on the line, and that he's under pressure to turn Ferrari around immediately. Otherwise, his ass could be in a sling. And while Fred Vasseur's like, we can't do our jobs if these journos say shit like this, basically. Like, Hamilton had to come out and say, Fred Vasseur is the reason I'm here. Which is about as generous as you can get from Lewis trying to shut this down, saying, I'm here because of him. This team runs through him, and it runs through me. So, of course, it was an impassioned defense in regards to Fred Vasseur. But, unfortunately, I think Formula One is going the way of a lot of other sports, like football, like the NBA, where you could now be one bad year and you're out.
You could have one great year, and the result may not be what you want, and you're still out. Hi, Knicks fans listening to this. Those who've been on the show previously.
Fred Vasseur was this close to the Constructors' Championship last year.
Yeah.
First year in the job, he nearly won a world title. He was one development misstep in the middle of the year away from winning the Constructors title.
There were a whole lot of people who were one development misstep in the middle of 2024 away.
The opportunity was there for Ferrari, no doubt about it.
Yeah, they were one not quite as good pit stop as it could have been away from winning the championship, genuinely. But this year has not been that. And the notion that they should drop Fred Vasseur from this team, it is truly insane Ferrari fandom bullshit.
It's crazy. Like, okay, Ferrari are nowhere near as good this year as they were last year. Not disputing that for a second. They have been poor, relatively speaking, compared to what they were at their best last year when they were able to win multiple races and was a contender right till the end of the championship last season. You don't fire the guy after a year and a half because, you know what it is? It's like saying you nearly won the Champions League last year and then you're going to fire him for not going back to the final a year afterwards. Like, the expectations here are way too high. Look, you cannot sit there and sympathize with what Lewis Hamilton is struggling with right now as an F1 team, and then in the same breath say Fred Vasseur needs to be fired. You committed
to at least two
years of Lewis Hamilton. You moved on Carlos Sainz and his team for that reason. You've got to understand there's going to be teething problems here. Even with the GOAT, you've got to understand that this is going to take some time. This is not straightforward. Like,
I think
Ferrari,
one goes in hand with the other at the moment, Dre.
Have blown through everything change-wise to try and figure this out. And it still hasn't quite worked out in that way.
Well, I think the Italian media thought this was a recipe for instant success, and that's just not how it works. And at the moment, you have to look at the form of this year's car. This year's Ferrari has been poor, has been mid at the best of times and outright poor at the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And Lewis Hamilton has been getting shellacked by Charles Leclerc practically every weekend. There's rumors that Charles wants out. I don't know if I believe those. I feel like that's just, again, trying to pour gasoline on a fire to try and destabilize Ferrari. I do not get what they are thinking, what they are smoking, what they could possibly imagine would be a suitable replacement for Vasseur. Well, they're going into a new regulation set. Famously, yeah. Things at Ferrari worked really well when we went into new regulations from 2013 to 14, and they started burning through people left and right. Remember Marco Mattiacci as Ferrari team principal?
Oh,
all for
that was like a crazy month.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. I just try to wrap my head around, like, because I thought for a second, like, well, he's been long enough at the job that he should get, like, a bit of a shorter leash for that. No, he's only been on the job since 2023.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he marks what broke a cycle of five team principals at Ferrari in the last 10 years.
I don't think there's any cycle broken here if the powers that be at Ferrari get their way. And with what we have heard, what the rumblings have been out of Ferrari for the 2026 project, given they haven't sounded at all confident in their new engine, like, I don't expect this to get better. I expect this to get worse. And I think Fred will be a casualty of the political nature of the Ferrari team principal job. And I think that's incredibly stupid. I also think it is incredibly, inexorably Ferrari.
Annoyingly, they are the Gavin and Stacey of Formula One teams. Oh, the drama, Mick. Oh, the drama. I love it, etc. Where it's just Ferrari almost, like, embraces being the circus sometimes. Like, it's a bit like Alpine, but it's, like, apparently more fun.
I think it's worse than that. I think that they don't think they're a circus because they're Ferrari.
But when you build a Formula One team on the principle of championship or bust, You can't be that way in Formula One. It's too volatile a sporting environment for that.
Well, remember, they started winning championships and stayed winning championships because Michael, Ross Brawn, and John Todd sealed themselves together within the team, said, look, if one of us goes, all of us go.
Yeah.
So you are going to leave us alone and you are going to let us work. And it produced five championships consecutively. It produced another with Kimi Raikkonen a couple years later. And the constructors, ignore the fact that McLaren got disqualified from the World Constructors Championship that
counts.
Year.
It counts.
And it counted the next year when they won another Constructors Championship.
That's the problem. We're now at 17 years since their last major championship. And it's even worse because McLaren broke their duck last year. And their duck was almost as long. So now,
just as long.
So now,
2008.
Yeah. So now Ferrari are the big team who now has the long ass dry spell. 17 years and counting, and they're not winning one this year.
Yeah.
The way this team is currently constructed, with the rumors coming out of next year, do they win one anytime soon? This not if they start burning through staff.
You know, this reminds me a lot of another prominent red team in the sport that's gone a long time without winning a championship after years and years of unprecedented success. And going into next year, does it look like they're going to win a championship, Dre Harrison?
Not anytime soon. As Cam quite rightly says, they're not winning a title this year. Next year's a total crapshoot, but the confidence in the camp seems to be low. So I don't think that's going to work out. Who knows what the next hybrid era brings? We just don't know what it's going to look like. They've got the driving talent for it. They've got the resources for it. But that's never stopped Ferrari failing at any point during the last 17 years.
And not while Mercedes sounds exceedingly confident in their next engine. And oh, by the way, have to have a championship caliber driver now and a potential championship caliber driver who just got his first podium.
Good luck. One more big story as well. The news came through today. Canada will be sticking around on the F1 calendar until 2035.
Let's go.
They've signed
not the 53rd state. Not a fourth US round.
Yeah, drink your Tim Hortons and grab some Timbits. Canada's going to be around for 9 more years. And good, because it's one of the best tracks on the calendar.
This race was kind of a stinker until the last 5 laps, but generally speaking, the Canadian Grand Prix is a good effect. What I don't like is that the Canadian Grand Prix is running up against the Indianapolis 500, likely in the same broadcast window on the same day. Oh, and we also got Spain coming against Le Mans.
Here we go. So here's a quick rundown of the 2026 F1 calendar for those who may not have seen it already. Australia back in the season opening slot on March 8th to kick us off. China is on March 15th. Then we go to Japan again for round 3 on March 29th. Like this year, Bahrain and Saudi Arabia are back-to-back, both in April, to compensate for Ramadan. Miami is around 6. That's a couple things. The sport takes 2 weeks off after Saudi Arabia, which is interesting. Miami is around 6 on May 3rd. Then the spicy one. As RJ quite rightly says, next year's Canadian Grand Prix will be on May 24th, likely with F1 competing head-to-head with the Indianapolis 500, almost certainly in the same time slot. That's not going to go well for anybody.
That hasn't gone well for anybody. Good luck for that. You remember the last time a prominent open wheel series decided to run head-to-head against the Indianapolis 500, Cam Buckley?
All I'm saying is Max Verstappen has the chance to achieve a race ban in the funniest way possible.
No kidding. We return to this.
I think they should run it at Michigan. They should run it on an oval.
Yeah, just don't crash before the green starts. F1 returns to the streets of Monaco on June 7th. Then the Spanish Grand Prix, now renamed the Barcelona Catalunya Grand Prix, on June 14th. Remember that, it becomes important later. That now is before Austria on June 28th, ahead of Great Britain. Obviously, Silverstone on July 5th. Belgium's a couple of weeks after that. It's now part of a doubleheader with Hungary the week after, July's 19th and 26th. Then the summer break kicks in. They return a month later at the Netherlands for its final Grand Prix at Zandvoort. 2 weeks after that, they race in Italy and Monza. Then the brand new Majoring, the only major change on the calendar. Round 16, the new Spanish Grand Prix at what they're nicknaming the Majoring in Madrid, September 13th. And I think that might be going head-to-head with the Catalunya MotoGP race. Traditionally, that race is now in September. I wonder if Dorna is going to react to that later and maybe move Catalunya a week early. Just a thought.
Dorna? You mean Liberty?
Anyway, 2 weeks after that, Baku in Azerbaijan on September 27th. Singapore is going to be on October 11th. And for round 18, Austin is October 25th. That is the first part of a... Oh, and by the way, 6 races in 7 weeks to close out the season. A triple header of Austin, Mexico, and Sao Paulo into Lagos. A week off, and then the traditional... I hate to call it traditional now, but it's still a thing. Vegas, Qatar, Abu Dhabi, triple header to close it out with the championship finishing on December the 6th. 24 rounds and with 3 preseason tests, I think it's fair to say this is going to be the longest and toughest Formula One calendar in history. Good luck. Thoughts, gentlemen?
None.
I think Formula One clashing with both of the other two legs of the Triple Crown of motorsport is crazy, but this is kind of becoming inevitable with how big and bloated and stupidly long the calendar is.
And it's not a secret. I mean, given the way things are marketed, given the way that they've positioned themselves, it's not exactly like it's not by accident.
No, it definitely isn't. And look, it is not totally Formula One's fault. This is everybody, really, because when it comes to global motorsport, their cake when it comes to revenue generation is pretty much baked. The only bona fide, surefire way of making more money on a calendar year is by hosting more races.
Yep.
There's no getting around that fact now. And everybody...
The 25 Super Bowls a year line is baked into our brains.
Yep. And every major motorsport series we know has gotten bigger with their calendars in the last decade. Formula One was still at 20 races 10 years ago. It's now at 24. MotoGP was locked in at 18 for a good decade and a half. It's now at 22. You know, IndyCar is now, that's one of the smaller gains. I think it's now 17, and it used to be 15 or 16. They've now crammed 17.
IndyCar people say that that's too short.
Yeah, because
fans of the World Endurance Championship are pissed that we didn't add a 9th round.
Yeah, because IndyCar is now done in August to avoid the NFL. They're so shit scared of football, they're cramming 17 rounds into the back end of the summer because their starts are so slow. Like, this is the way the sausage is made now. More races, more calendars, more guaranteed revenue, and that's why Formula One's now got calendar rotation coming into play from 2027 onwards, because at the moment... they can't facilitate everybody. So they're going to now make countries thirsty for it by putting them on 2-year cycles. We've already seen that with Belgium. Imola's gone. And I wonder what the next move is going to be in regards to that. Because,
Zandvoort's going out. But then what comes in for its place?
Thailand. It was said today.
And also just put up $1.2 billion to try and bring an F1 race in.
Oh, you mean to Chang International Circuit at Buriram, which already has a proven pedigree of hosting exceptional races in MotoGP and other four-wheel championships, right?
No.
Street track in Bangkok.
Well, okay, I know Buriram's hard to get to, but like, dog.
Yeah, street track, middle of the country.
It's They've taken the one page out of Formula E's books that I kind of wish they had, and it's, we're going to bring the racing to the city streets.
Yeah.
That always produces great product on draft.
You know, it's so funny that Formula One people screamed at Formula E to be more like Formula One, and now that just means it's more like Formula E.
Converged on their own.
Yeah.
Oh!
They've absorbed each other like osmosis, where they're both now eating off each other's plates like it's a really hot date or something. You know, like it's
hey, yo.
It's Lady and the Tramp and the spaghetti all over again. It's like they're both doing the same thing.
No, it's a political cartoon where the skinny guy is just desperate for drops out of the pipeline, and the fat dude with the wide mouth is going, oh
yeah. Look, the calendar, in my opinion, is mostly fine. I do generally like the fact that Formula One is genuinely made a good effort in trying to get these rounds closer together geographically to cut down on the travel. If you're going to have double or triple headers, at least cut down on the travel, which is arguably the most exhausting element of it. However, 6 out of 7 to close it out, including that horrible Vegas Qatar leg, should not be a thing. It is stupid. Like, that's like a 6,000-mile trip. That is so dumb. I hate the fact that we're still doing that. There is no good reason for Vegas and Qatar to be intertwined like that. It's bullshit. Especially after you've already done 21 Grand Prix, and that's round 22 going into 23. I hate it. It's stupid. If there's one thing I've noticed from the last 2 years being a Formula One fan, is that everybody is exhausted by Vegas. It's why people were like, can we do less media? Because everyone is tired. Like, everything is stupid. And yeah, it's not ideal at all. And I don't like it. And it's dumb.
Yeah, it feels like the horse is out of the stable at this point. We're never going back.
No.
If anything, it's we're going to eventually hit a breaking point. But until we get there, we're not going to know what that is.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I don't disagree. And Canada competing against the 500 is just stupid and dumb and bad for everybody.
That's broadcast suicide.
Why?
Like,
what do you gain from that?
Because, you know what? Because any eyes that they take off the 500 is a win for them. And that's stupid. That is a stupid way to go about business.
No one wins. When that happens, no one wins.
No one wins, but in F1's eyes, if IndyCar doesn't win, then they win.
It's the cockroach strategy. You try to crush them, even though, as we saw earlier this year, you can't beat the 500 in a pissing contest. You will lose. Like, this is 500. 7 million people watched this year's 500. 7 million. You're not winning.
It wasn't
that
even
fight.
That good of a 500.
It was.
I love the winner.
I don't think for F1 it's about beating the 500. I think it's about wounding the 500.
Yeah, make race fans choose, and that's not good for anybody. Like, people think just flooding the market with the same shit is going to make everybody win and hype each other up. This is not pro wrestling. It doesn't work like that in Formula One. It doesn't work like that in motorsport. It's just, all you've done is alienated your consumers. That's all it is. And no one wins when that shit happens.
No.
So, yeah. We'll see how that plays out. I think the calendar mostly is fine for what it is. It's just those two big sticking points I don't like. But we'll have to wait and see how that goes. Formula One will be back in a week and change in Austria for the Austrian Grand Prix. Red Bull's home round, Max's last chance to pick up a race ban, and hey, maybe we'll get Norris versus Verstappen 2, side pod boogaloo. We'll have to wait and see, but we'll be back next week to talk that out. Le Mans review up next. Until then, I've been Dre Harrison, they've been RJ O'Connell and Cameron Buckley. Until next time, thank you very much for listening. Sayonara.
Thank you, y'all.
Personally, I think we should put the 500, the 24 hours of Le Mans, and Monaco all on the same day. Make it the worst clash for everyone involved.